Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 188, I chat with journalists Barb Gonzalez, Jeff Morrison, and Mike Heiss about the most significant AV stories of 2013 and what we expect to see at CES next month. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded December 30th, 2013, episode 188, 2013 and beyond. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and Director of Content at AVSForum.com. This week, we will be taking a look at 2013, just like every other show in the world, with a panel of experts that I have assembled, all of whom have been on the show before. Let's start with Barb Gonzalez, otherwise known as the Simple Tech Guru. She writes for Sound and Vision and for Sears, and on her own website, she's got a couple of books, a very active member of the press corps. Hey, Barb, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
So glad to have you here. Next up is Jeff Morrison, who is a freelance writer and hair model. Very successful hair model, indeed, who writes for CNET and Forbes and lots of others. And is also an author of science fiction novels. Hey, Jeff, welcome back.
Hey, Scott. Great to be here.
Great to have you with us. And finally, we have Mike Heiss, who is a freelancer also, writes for Residential Systems, HiddenWires.com, and he's a jolly good CEDIA fellow. Hey, Mike, hey, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on the show.
You bet. So those of you who are tuned in live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for the panel as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. So what we want to talk about today is the most significant AV stories of 2013, and there were quite a few. I think probably I asked AVS Forum, I posted a question, and I asked AVS Forum what they thought the most important stories were, and by far the one that got cited the most was Panasonic leaving the plasma business. Jeff, would you agree that's an important story of the year?
Yeah, I mean, it's an important story. I wouldn't necessarily call it a surprising one, though. I mean, they have been losing money as a company for years, and plasma has never done the kind of sales that LCD does for any number of reasons. So, yeah, I mean, it was an important story, especially seeing as this year's Panasonic plasmas were unbelievably good, and which is kind of a fitting swan song, I guess, to their involvement in plasma. Mm-hmm. But I think the other side of that, which almost makes it not necessarily okay, but I mean, this year we also finally saw OLED.
Exactly.
And OLED, you know, OLED's certainly going to hopefully take over, well, already has taken over the picture quality crown from plasma, and it's only a matter of time till they get cheap enough that, you know, we can all afford them.
Well, that is certainly one of my questions. Will they get cheap enough? There are manufacturing yield problems that keep them expensive, I think. Panasonic and Sony had announced a joint venture to make OLED, in particular some sort of printing technology. But their recent announcement was that they weren't going to do that after all. They weren't going to join into that.
I believe that was only a limited partnership, a limited time partnership anyway. I don't think that was kind of like they broke up. I mean, I think it was a planned thing, that they were going to do it.
He's right. The agreement from what's being reported in Washington Trade Press is that the original venture was to develop the technology, not necessarily to implement it. And I think it's pretty fair to say that they're both going to have OLEDs. Maybe they won't make them themselves. You know, Sony doesn't make all the LCDs, LCD LEDs that they sell.
Right.
Make any of them, I don't think.
No, and also remember, there's still, at least for the time being, plasma from Samsung and LG, whether it's as as good as the Panasonic, formerly Pioneers, is in the eye of the beholder.
Right, right. Barb, any comments on the plasma, Panasonic leaving the plasma business? Do you think we'll see Samsung and Sony will have plasmas at CES?
Well, I read the same thing that you did. I saw that Sony was going to get out of making OLEDs. They were going to abandon it for right now. But I haven't got any more details about that. Mm-hmm. You know,
it's well, not really we'll my... certainly see. That's not really your area of yeah. speciality, shall we say.
Yeah. Samsung and LG have both said that they are going to have plasmas at CES.
At CES.
So there will be plasmas in existence for 2014, but, you know, past that, who knows? It's, I think, with those two companies especially, I think it's kind of a question of which one's going to blink first. You know, if Samsung keeps making plasmas, LG's probably going to keep still making plasmas.
Right.
But then they'll sell the fabs to some Chinese guy who'll make them.
Right, right. I'm getting a lot of comments in the chat room about how people have bought Panasonic plasmas this year, and I think that that's a good thing. SoCal Ray Jr. Just bought a VT60. Somebody else in here, I can't find it at the moment, bought an ST60. And, you know, I think it's a good idea. A lot of people ask me, well, gosh, if they're getting out of the plasma, if plasma's dying as a product category, should I really buy one?
And I don't see why not.
I say absolutely.
Yeah. Sure.
What does that have to do with it? Because you can't buy it later.
Well,
I mean, it's great technology.
Exactly, exactly. But it's also a matter of support. It's like, will the company support the product? And if it fails within the warranty period, you know, will they be able to replace it? I think the answer is yes.
Yeah, they've said that they're going to stand by that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, I was amazed. I visited Pioneer's factory this year, I guess must have been in the summer, and they have row upon row of Kuro TVs that they have to keep in stock for, I think they said 7 years, to make sure that they can honor, you know, the warranties of the products that are out there.
Yeah, in California, at least, the law is you have to support them for at least 7 years with parts.
Right. Exactly.
And in 7 years, any TV that you're buying now is going to be so horribly obsolete. That, you know?
Right. Yeah. Right, exactly. Taylor Karras is responding to Mr. Lushi that black levels are everything. Can't stand the glow of regular LCD light. Which, Jeff, brings me back to the point you made, which is that OLED, or OLED as it's often called, has taken the crown already from plasma as far as the best possible picture quality.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I reviewed both the Samsung OLED and the Panasonic ZT60, which was their top of the line and probably the best plasma. I would argue the best plasma ever made. I mean, it's definitely everyone has fond memories of the Kuro, but
right.
I don't know. But yeah. That's a whole other conversation, I guess. But
right.
But yeah, the OLEDs, and I've seen the LG. I didn't review it, but I've seen it. And they're... The OLED is the contrast ratio in the OLEDs is so much better than even what's possible on the ZT60 or any display technology other than OLED. The picture is just so three dimensional and lifelike and just a joy to watch. It's so much better than everything else out there.
Yeah, but that does bring up the question of curved screens. Both the Samsung and the LG OLEDs, which were finally released to the public this year. This was the first year you could actually buy an OLED TV of a reasonable size. But they're only 55 inches. You can't get anything bigger or smaller. That's all there is. And the screens are curved. What do you guys think of that? Mike, what's your hit on the curved screen phenomenon?
One of them isn't curved enough that it makes a difference. The other one is too curved, and they have their reasons for doing it. I am not a fan of it, but we will see some flat OLEDs at CES.
You think so?
Yeah, I mean, the curved thing adds cost to it that is, as they go down market, they're just not going to be able to stick to it. Whether it's good or not is going to become besides the point from a competitive standpoint. They're going to have to go flat just to keep the pricing in line.
But do you think, I mean, why did they do this curved thing in the first place? I ask them and they say, well, it's to differentiate the product from...
Because they could.
Because they could, essentially.
But seriously, that's probably not far off the case. They wanted to give some additional novelty to it because outside of the home theater geeks world, does the average consumer, albeit one that's going to spend the money that these things cost, are they going to be able to really appreciate the picture difference? Are they going to say, wow, look at my new OLED, or gee, I've got this curved TV just like you go to the dome?
Right, right.
How do they explain it to their friends or justify it to their significant other?
That they spent $9,000 on a 55-inch TV.
Well, yeah. I think the problem is as well that picture quality has never sold televisions. I mean, we like to think that it does, but in reality, you know, that's another one of the reasons why LCD has done so well. It's kind of proof that, you know, everyone says that plasma looks better, and yet LCDs obviously sell in significantly more numbers.
Hugely more numbers.
You know, it's a brightness issue. It's what looks best on the show floor at Best Buy or Costco, and in that OLED is certainly bright and brighter than plasma, and in some cases you can even get it brighter than LCD. But would you really notice the difference between that and a $1,000 LCD and when they're sitting next to each other at Costco? Probably not. I mean, under those harsh lighting conditions. So at that point, the companies are probably very logically saying, well, we're trying to sell an $8,000 television. It's going to look the same on the show floor as a $1,000 television. What can we do to make sure that this thing's different? And the curve is, I think, the answer to a question that no one asked. Well, other than the sales aspect.
Yeah, yeah.
But remember, I think
what Michael's right is that we're going to see flat OLEDs at the show, absolutely.
And just remember, Sony has that curved LCD set, and I bet it probably hasn't sold too much. I'll be curious to see if they still have it at CES.
Well, we do know that there's going to – well, before we get too far into what's it's going to be at CES, because that's definitely a part of this conversation, but I'd like to hold off on that for a minute. Barb, what do you think of the curved screen? Do you have you spent much time in front of one? Do you like the idea?
You know, I haven't spent enough time to really say that would be something that I would want.
Mm-hmm.
But firstly, I'm not going to be able to put it on my wall.
Right.
For the wife factor, I'm not going to be able to put this curved screen on my wall.
Right.
The only reason that anybody I would know would have it, like Jeff was saying about people not really understanding or caring about quality of picture, is that aren't I cool?
Right.
So
it's a coolness factor thing.
But I haven't spent enough time to recommend it or not recommend it. So.
Well, I've seen it, and I actually reviewed more or less. I calibrated Leo's Samsung, and it looks fabulous. But the curved aspect of it turns it into a solitary experience, really, because if you're not dead center from that curve...
That's what I was wondering, yeah.
Yeah, the geometry looks weird. OLED doesn't have the off-axis problems that LCD does, but if you've got this curved screen and you go off-axis, the geometry of the screen looks weird of the picture, so...
And it's not just the horizontal axis. You also have a problem with the vertical axis.
Right.
So, because, you have to be dead center not only this way, but this way. And if you don't, and even sometimes if you do, depending on where you're sitting, you've got, as Gary Merson, who's kind of, we all know Gary, he describes it as the smiley face, frowny face. That if there's especially if you're watching a 2.35:1 movie, the letterbox bars, they kind of look like they curve up at the top and curve down at the bottom. And it's just, you have to be in such a rigid seating position. Like I said, I reviewed both of I reviewed this Samsung and I've seen the LG. And in reality, the curve is very slight. And what the marketing people try to tell you about how it's a more immersive experience, of course, is rubbish.
Yes.
In a huge screen, 100 plus inches or something. And it's kind of cool. You could have it more of a wraparound. But no, it's just it's a novelty and a distraction.
Did you guys see the announcement, the press release that I forget who it was now. A couple companies are going to have like 105-inch, 2.35:1 LCD TVs in a curved form factor at the show.
Science that's a good size project. Of it.
What's
it? It's a science project. And how do you get it through the door? Remember, they bend, but only once.
But only once. And Web 1944 in the chat room says that Samsung announced 110-inch OLED today. I didn't see that yet.
$150,000.
$150,000. Start saving your pennies now.
The signage market. I mean, people forget that Panasonic has sold an enormous number of those 103-inch plasmas, which I'm curious if they're going to still make, or even if they're still making it, in the commercial market.
Mm-hmm. And they also make that 152-inch for like half a million bucks.
Commercialized.
Yeah. I mean, you have to build your house around that thing.
If you're going to go that big, get a projector.
Exactly. Exactly. And then you may want a curved screen.
But then you can't.
Well, listen, one of the other really big stories of 2013 is the explosion of UHD, Ultra HD, which generally refers to the pixel resolution, four times the pixel resolution of HD. 3460 by 2140, if I got that right? 2160. 3840 by 2160. Four times the number of pixels as conventional HD, which I've heard some people now start to refer to as standard def.
Oh, please.
So let me get each of your hits on this whole UHD, the appearance of UHD in the market. Really an explosion. Tons of sets were released this year. What do you think, Barb? Is that something worthwhile, or is what's going on there?
Well, I mean, we're at that same place where, you know, each time the resolution goes up, they say we don't have enough content and everything.
Right.
Although I have heard that some of the algorithms that Netflix is using for their 1080p, they're going to be able to use for UHD.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm getting older or something, but at what point is it too much resolution, you know? How much do we need?
Yeah,
I can already sit right up next to my 55-inch TV and really not see many pixels at all, and see really wonderful detail. But maybe you guys like it better.
Well, I have my problems with it, but I want to hear what you guys say first. Jeff, what's your hit on the whole UHD thing?
Well, you know, it's funny. I've written a bunch of articles now for the past couple of years just kind of decrying it as really kind of stupid. I mean,
stupid.
And I've gotten a ridiculous amount of flack and certainly a lot of hate mail and people calling me blind and stupid and making fun of the fact that I wear glasses and, you know, the usual quality conversations.
Yeah, right.
But in reality, it's just, you know, there's a physiological aspect to it that your eye has limited resolution, and most people sit 10 feet from a 50-inch TV or less. And in that size and that distance, you're not going to be able to see the difference. You're not really even going to see the difference between 720p and 1080p at that distance and that size, which I've tested with multiple people and all this other, you know, but doesn't matter. Most people aren't going to believe you when you say that, so it doesn't matter. But with 4K, it's like, it's not really needed. I mean, 1080p, like Barbara was saying, 1080p is plenty. It's plenty resolution for what we have now.
Right.
You know, you were just talking about that 150-inch TV or even 100-inch TV or any of these things. That's kind of the promise of OLED, that you could have cheap, enormous screens with incredible resolution. And in that case, then, yeah, 4K is amazing. If you're getting a TV that's big enough, if you're getting or if you're sitting closer to it, then the extra resolution is awesome. But for the most part right now, it's just not really needed. And when there's so little content and all this, that, you know, is that the progression? Is that the way we're going to go? Yeah, probably. But I don't think anyone really needs to worry about this now or even for the next few years at best, unless, you know, they're getting a projector or a huge screen.
Right, right. Mike, what about you?
Well, I think it's also volume driven. And the other sort of unknown is how much in the way of 4K product are the now third tier trying to be second tier, the Seikis and the Hisenses and the TCLs of the world.
Yep.
We saw the Seiki set didn't look that good to some people's eyes, didn't sell that well. The day you go into Costco and there's a 4K Vizio for $1,500, then you know it's arrived. And I don't think, we didn't see it this past year. I'm not so sure we'll see it in the year ahead.
Now, Jeff, you reviewed the Seiki, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
That was a 50 or a 55-inch?
50 inch. I think when I finished the review, they had dropped the price down to $1,200 or something.
And now it's under $1,000, I think.
Yeah. I mean, my takeaway of it was just, it was a really crummy LCD that just happens to be 4K.
Mm-hmm.
There's no, like, the color was fairly accurate, but the contrast ratio was terrible. I mean, all the negatives about LCD it had, almost all of them. But it was a really high resolution screen. So for some people, that's all they wanted, and that's fine. And, you know, I was actually considering when they had a 39-inch 4K TV that they were selling. I think there were some giveaway prices at like $400. And I was considering getting one because for a computer monitor, that would be awesome.
Ah, there you go. Sure, of course.
You're sitting so close to it that, yeah, absolutely. You have all the screen real estate. You can look. I mean, I shoot a lot of photography, so it's, you know, being able to see a much greater detail with the full screen. Because you're sitting 2 feet away from it.
Exactly.
But 50-inch, it was just... A lot of the flaws that people ascribe to the Seiki weren't probably so much the panel as they are the scaling. If you remember at Simty Scott, those things were all over the place. I've been to some other trade demonstrations since then. When fed a decent 4K signal, it doesn't look that bad. It's when you try and make it upscale that it fell apart.
Right.
I'd argue kind of the other way of that, of saying that it looked especially bad when it was trying to scale it itself. I wouldn't really think that it ever really looked good, even if you were feeding it a native 4K signal. I mean, it was a mediocre LCD. But yes, I mean, if you just try to send it 1080p and have it scale that up, it was really bad.
Yeah. Did you ever send it native 4K content? Maybe from the computer.
They supplied a server with some native 4K, test material stuff, standard slow-moving landscapes, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It looked – that was it when it looked its best. I also sent it 4K from a computer, my own gaming computer, and then I'm actually reviewing an HTPC right now from Steiger, and that will do 4K. And so I was doing some 4K gaming on it.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you have to sit so close to it to see that extra resolution that – I think I was sitting maybe 4 feet from it to get the most out of it.
Right.
And that part, yeah, I mean, it definitely looked its best sending it that way, but
still
was never great.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that really, that I think about a lot in terms of UHD is that the TV manufacturers are all making these TVs now that you can buy that have this UHD, some call it 4K. I think that's a bit of a misnomer, but still, this enhanced resolution. But it doesn't, they don't take into account anything else like expanded color gamut or high dynamic range or greater bit depth. And so my general recommendation is if somebody says, should I buy a 4K TV now? I say no.
Well, then there's also the whole, I mean, everything you said, absolutely. And then also on top of that, the fact that the current sets generally aren't going to be upgradable to HDMI 2.0, which has a whole other, frame rate issues and all this other stuff that you would need from that. And they don't, I mean, the major manufacturers are talking about that they'll have some sort of, most of them are saying that they'll have an upgrade path for their current 4K sets to HDMI 2.0, but not all of them.
And one more thing is that they need to have or would preferably have HEVC built in for compatibility with 4K streaming.
Right. Because we're probably going to see 4K use a new type of video codec, HEVC or H.265. You really need that decoding in the TV in order to make that work. But getting back to HDMI 2.0, this is an important point that Mike, you and I have talked about on the show.
Yeah.
we have this new version of HDMI, which is usually called HDMI 2.0, although HDMI licensing board really doesn't like us to use numbers anymore, but we're going to anyway. Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, but my impression is that it's barely adequate for UHD as it is now, much less if we add enhanced dynamic range and expanded color gamut and greater bit depth and all that stuff.
Up to a point. It's good up to a point.
Mm-hmm.
And once you, if you were really to ask it to do, and this is going to get ultra geeky.
Hey, that's what we're here for.
Color and 444 color sampling. You're gonna overshoot it. The question is, do you want to, you know, place your bet on the connection technology or having to need it? And it's more than good enough for what it is. But the bigger problem is our pals at HDMI really haven't figured out how to communicate that to the public. And I'm concerned that that's already caused confusion in 2013, and it's going to continue to cause confusion in 2014.
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of afraid of that, too. And a lot of people ask me about DisplayPort and why don't we use DisplayPort?
Because of the ubiquity of HDMI.
Exactly. Right?
Where's the Panasonic set has got DisplayPort, and DisplayPort and Thunderbolt. I was going to say ThunderPants. are somewhat more than somewhat related.
Yeah.
But you need it. Is there a cable box, a satellite box, a Blu-ray player, a Roku, and anything on the content side that will have other than a PC or a Mac, obviously, it's going to have that kind of connectivity. And it's just, HDMI is just, it's here, it's real, get used to it.
Right. Somebody in the chat room, I'm trying to find it here. Oh, USB. Another HDMI? When will it ever stop? Someone
Never.
Stop the madness.
Well, the good thing, though, and this is one piece, and I still agree with you that it is generally, you know, barely keeping up with what we need.
Yeah.
But at least at HDMI 2.0, there's no new cables. That's, I think, the biggest advantage to it is
good
that you can
point.
Use your current cables. If you upgrade and you have an HDMI 2.0 TV and you have an HDMI 2.0 source, your current high-speed cables will probably work just fine, or they should work just fine.
Mm-hmm. Mike, do you agree on that?
Yes, but probably if you're just sticking with a 3 meter, but if you're going to go beyond a 3-4 meter and really pushing it to the max, you'll find that you'll not be able to go as great a length with the cables without going active.
Mm-hmm. Somebody in the chat room here, Edmonton Oiler guy in the chat room. I work part-time at Costco in the majors department, the TVs. I find that 70% of customers think they know about TV technology, but they don't. that's a whole other issue of educating people, which is what all of us here on this panel are all about. We want to try and educate people about things, and that's what we're doing today.
Really helpful is any time that I try to write an article, especially on CNET, where I try to explain a technology and something that's really heady, it's really helpful that there's a lot of people who will comment with completely inaccurate information, and that really adds to the conversation.
Well, it gives you a chance to set the record straight. If you follow the comments.
It does, and I do, and I try to respond to, you know, clear things up, and especially if I can link to some other articles that I've written. It's like, well, no, it's this, and but it's still, it's that in and of itself could be a full-time job.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Sticking with HDMI 2.0 for a moment longer, then there's the issue of manufacturers who have this year said either A, we will be able to update or upgrade to HDMI 2.0. Samsung is the best example with their Evolution Box, little module that you slap on the back of the TV and it gives you new hardware. And others that say, oh, we've got HDMI 2.0 right now, but they can't because the hardware, the chipsets, haven't yet been introduced into the consumer marketplace. I mean, I'm sure manufacturers are working with them now, but there are no TVs this year that have the 2.0 chipset, right?
Well, the other problem, that's where you get into the problem of what is HDMI 2.0. Because if you're just going to go up to the 300 megahertz version, you can't push that through the existing chips. If you're going all the way out to the full bore max, you do need the new chips. And those aren't going to be readily available to the market for a little while yet.
Right.
So that's just going to add to the confusion, already has.
Right. And I think we'll see TVs and other products with the actual HDMI 2.0 chipset in them at CES, and then we'll be able to buy them sometime next year.
Hopefully.
So, yeah. Barb, we got you back. I think we had a little trouble there, but I'm glad to see you're back. And that's good, because my next question really has to do with streaming, which is your area of particular expertise. Yes. And I'd like to know what you think the big streaming stories of 2013 were.
Well, the biggest streaming story of 2013 has to be Chromecast.
Mm.
Not necessarily the best.
I didn't say the best.
but it's definitely Chromecast. I mean, having a little dongle that costs $35 or less.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's over 10 apps that you can stream to it. So you can stream HBO, you can stream Hulu, you can stream Netflix.
Can you stream stuff. Amazon Instant Video yet to Chromecast?
I don't think so. No. I don't think so.
Okay.
But there's so much that you can stream to it, and because it's not actually streaming from your phone, it's streaming directly from the internet. You're getting full resolution. And
I thought it was a mirroring thing from your phone. Am I wrong on that?
No, remember we had that conversation about Dial, which is that the phone is telling the Chromecast, go to this particular URL.
Yep.
And then it goes and gets it itself.
I see. Okay. So you're really only controlling or telling the Chromecast where to go from the phone, so
and
to speak.
At this point, all it is it's like any of those mirroring, like Miracast or AirPlay, in that all you have to do is tap a little icon on phone, and it immediately goes right to the Chromecast. It's really quite good. I don't know that it's the way I'd only like to do it. I don't use it all the time, but sometimes it really works quite, you know, and it's small enough you can take it with you.
Yeah.
I think it's work in progress. I just completed binge viewing of a Korean drama on Hulu using a Chromecast, and I want a remote. I mean, the Dial thing is cool, but if the phone rings and you want to pause, you go, wait, oh, where's the tablet or the phone that you're using to control it? And you have to pause it there. And that's just for Chromecast is $35. For another $15, you can get one of the less expensive Rokus or Netgear boxes that kind of do the same thing. And remember that, and Barb, please correct me if I'm wrong, but even in a Nexus 7, that's as Google as you can get, you can't mirror out of Chrome on their own tablet. That's the part that
because you can't use Chrome on, you can't mirror, right, you can't take it from Chrome on your tablet, but you can on the computer.
But the computer doesn't live in the room where most people watch TV.
Right. Right.
True enough.
It doesn't have everything that you're going to want to have. It doesn't have everything from Chrome, so they're still adding a lot of stuff to it. And at some point, I imagine that they will be able to do Chrome to the Chromecast from a tablet or a phone. But for right now, I mean, it's great that Google finally has Hulu Plus. You know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of content that I would watch normally, and I can get it on my Chromecast. And if I really need like CBS or something else, I'll just go to my computer and do it from my computer. I think that the whole remote part of it in terms of the Chromecast is, doing it from Chrome is really kind of awkward, but doing it from your phone, it's just, you know, the fact that you can pick up any phone in the house or any tablet and go from one to the next and just immediately use that as the remote. Mm-hmm. I really think it's quite cool.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
The one place that it is cool, and you mentioned that, Scott, is a 2013 trend that I've seen a lot is hotels are actually now outboarding HDMI jacks in the room, so you can plug an external device into your TV, and it's a way to watch content on a hotel TV set. That part of it is kind of cool if you can navigate all the Wi-Fi.
But actually, I've done a lot of that too, and you really need to have some kind of little router, one of these.
A travel router.
Otherwise, you can't get like you couldn't get Chromecast, or you couldn't get like your Apple TV to recognize the internet from.
Really? Is that true? You can't take your Chromecast little dongle and plug it into the outboard HDMI port that a lot of hotels now offer, as Mike says? You can't just do that?
Well, no, because they always, most hotels that I've been to, and I go to a lot of hotels, I do a lot of traveling, most of them have either have that splash page where you either just agree that you're not going to do anything bad. Or you actually have to put in the password there. So you need something that's going to create some sort of hotspot, and you can do that with I know that, was it D-Link, I believe, has the SharePort one, and I haven't tried out this other one that I think is from Belkin.
Mm-hmm. And even if you could, in a lot of hotels, you'd get charged for a multi-device fee. So I've got a little net zero hotspot.
Oh, man.
And that's all presuming that the Wi-Fi is fast enough to actually get anything of quality.
Almost never.
Like it always is during CES.
Oh, man.
Not
exactly. If you've ever tried to stream something from CES, from your hotel at CES, man, that's...
I can't even check email sometimes. The internet's so slow.
Exactly. Well, a lot of people in the chat room have been asking about 4K streaming, and we were talking about UHD before, and I know that Netflix has announced and is maybe doing some trials with 4K streaming. Barb, what's the latest on that?
The latest I saw was an interview from Copenhagen, actually, of Reed Hastings saying that next year that they have the technology that could stream UHD at 15 megabits per second.
Megabits per second. I wonder how many homes have that reliably.
They say that at this point, it's between 10 and 20 is sort of the average nowadays. Mm. Mine is up to 130 now.
Yay. Oh, lucky you. Mine, unfortunately, isn't. So, Jeff, what do you hear about 4K streaming? Anything interesting?
Basically about the same that they're talking about. I think Netflix also announced, probably in that same interview maybe, that they... I think next year they will have the ability to stream their, and they're going to shoot their shows that they produce,
right,
in 4K. I don't know if that was a definite, but I think they were talking about that they had the ability at least.
Well, Barb, this brings up one of the points that you sent to me in preparation for this show, which is the rise of original series produced by Netflix and Hulu. You know,
it's
this,
crazy, isn't it?
It is. It really does indicate that maybe we are finally going into a cord-cutting world more so than ever before. 2013 certainly seems to have pointed us in that direction, don't you think?
I absolutely do. And the fact that Netflix actually got 14 Emmy nominations, and as well as a win for House of Cards. I think that it's great. It's like if you probably remember when HBO first started having series, and everybody kind of went, pay cable series and stuff. Mm-hmm. But now we've gone from, you know, those little YouTube webisodes to real high production value, high quality series, and them taking it really seriously. And you know, I'm certainly addicted, and my favorite thing is that I can binge watch it and I don't gain weight from binging.
Mike, you were telling us you were binge watching some Korean show. I didn't know you spoke Korean.
And I don't, of course. But once I figured out how to turn the closed captions on in Chrome, in the Hulu Plus with Chromecast, it's cool. And I mean, that's a side play of beginning to watch them through one of the digital sub-channels here in L.A. But I think one other thing, Barb, and maybe you know a little bit more about this since it's your hot area, is the fact that we're hearing a lot of talk that Netflix might actually get embedded in cable boxes, which when you look at it is like totally counter to the business model, because people would say that Netflix is competing with traditional distribution. On the other hand, if the whole TV Anywhere thing, which has been a very big trend, HBO Go is a good example, in 2013, if that begins to a la carte-size cable, or if they let you get HBO via $4.95 or $7.95 a month through an app independently of the cable service, that's really going to turn the whole business on its head.
Well, I think there's a couple things, Mike. I mean, one is keep your friends close, keep your enemies closer. You know? You know, maybe that's a little bit of that. You know, you can't beat them, join them. Mm. You know, that kind of thing too. But the other thing is that you know, when you're talking about TV anywhere, yeah, I would really love to have the a la carte, to not have to have everything and be able to get HBO. I fortunately or unfortunately have a Dish Hopper. And I have to say that no matter where I've been, even in Denmark, even when I was in Canada, I was able to watch my shows because I could stream from my DVR at home.
Because it has
Sling box
capability, right?
Yeah. So I was able to watch my, you know, Scandal when I was sitting in a hotel room on a farm in the middle of Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you can't do that unless you have some sort of TV and you're not cutting the cord. You actually have to have that satellite part of it.
Right.
But one of the things, of course, is that you don't get Showtime on the go if you're a Dish customer, because you know how much CBS hates Dish. Sorry, Jeff.
Jeff, have you cut the cord? Are you watching more streaming or not? Or
well, I mean, one of the things we were talking about was the binge watching, and I think one of the best examples of that was when they brought back when Netflix did Arrested Development,
mm-hmm.
and the season that they produced, it's beneficial to binge watch it because there's so much going on and think little things in one episode that'll be mentioned in another episode, and like you'll see something in the background of episode 2 and that'll be in the foreground of episode 6, and watching them all together you can pick up that. But if it had been a weekly show, there would have been so much that people would have missed, it would have almost not made any sense. And it was brilliant in that way to kind of take advantage of this new medium.
Yeah.
Of binge watching.
Yeah. Barb, you mentioned in the notes that you sent me before the show, put a note in there about integrating broadcast TV and OTT, or over the top. What we're talking about here exactly. Google TV tries to do it. I guess Xbox One also tries to do it.
Yeah, actually, they both do it.
They don't try. They actually do.
You know, everybody has been putting down Google TV, and I think it's kind of a little too complicated for the average consumer to really get.
Mm-hmm.
And but when you do a search for a TV show or a movie, it will give you when it's going to be on my Dish,
mm-hmm.
you know, as well as where I can get it on any of the other streaming free or rentals.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I want. If I want to know where it is, I want to be able to know if I can watch it on my TV provider.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that is an integration. I mean, yeah, there's not a lot of integration in terms of DVR, and it's not looking at my DVR, which I think it almost did for a while.
When it first started, I got the impression that it was looking at your DVR and telling you, oh, you've got this recorded on your DVR. It's also available on this station and on this streaming provider and so on, as you say, integrating it.
So it's gone backwards in that way. Mm. But the new Xbox One, it has a full very detailed, a lot of metadata and pictures and cover art and all that sort of thing, where you can just talk to the TV because it's the Kinect, and you say, you know, Xbox Watch TV show guide, and you can just go through the whole guide just by talking to it and telling it where you want to go. Again, not DVR.
Right.
You have to pick up your
right
satellite to play any of the... Well, you have to start it with your dish remote control. Mm-hmm. But then once you've started it, you can play, pause, and fast forward and stuff using the Xbox. So I just think it's great. It's going to only get better, I think.
Jeff, you're a gamer. Have you spent much time with the Xbox One or the PS4, which are other big stories in the home theater world as well as the gaming world?
I am a pretty big gamer, but I'm a very specific PC gamer. So consoles actually have very little interest in me. In fact, I think the only console I've ever purchased was the PlayStation 2. specifically,
oh, man,
and
you're
only
two generations ago.
Well, I mean, I have a PS3 and an Xbox 360, but they were, you know, I reviewed them and I reviewed games on them. Predominantly, I bought the PlayStation 2 and had a PlayStation 3 just to play Gran Turismo, which is kind of the best racing game ever made. Mm-hmm. When all the hoopla earlier this year about the two new consoles, I kind of was like really unimpressed from a gaming standpoint. Although, to be fair, I knew I would be. I mean, I'm not really that impressed by them anyway, because they're kind of just mediocre computers. They're really, you know, they do 1080p, and that's it. And the games will certainly eventually look better than the PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360. But these aren't big improvements. They're small improvements. Mm-hmm. Unlike PlayStation 2 to PlayStation 3 or Xbox 360, which basically brought us into HD. This is more of kind of an incremental improvement. There's still going to be issues with, you know, there'll be bigger, more polygons and bigger and better textures and stuff like yeah, the new consoles will look better than the old ones, but it's not as massive an improvement as those two companies would like you to believe, at least from a gaming standpoint. I think, you know, the other problem is like the mainstream and big, they call them AAA titles, you know, the blockbuster movies, essentially, of the gaming world, have gotten kind of progressively worse over the past few years. And,
really?
And it's possible that that's because of we're bumping up into limitations of the hardware of the, you know, the 3 and the 360.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think it's similar to how blockbuster movies have gotten kind of boring, and it's all sequels and it's the same plot. And don't get me wrong, I certainly enjoy, you know, an Iron Man movie and the Avengers, but they're certainly not creative, that the creativity and the new things are being brought out by small publishers, that there isn't a lot of money and there isn't a lot of marketing, so they can take more risks.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best games I've ever played was I think it was $10 title for the PlayStation 3 called Journey, and it was this short game. It's only about 3 or 4 hours, but it was a incredible experience. An emotional experience, and it had one of the best soundtracks of any media I've heard in ages, and it was $10, you know. So the consoles certainly have the ability to do interesting things, and I think both the PS4 and the Xbox One still to some extent are going to foster some of these independent titles, but I think there's far more interesting things going on in the PC space. And seeing as you could very easily put a PC in your home theater and treat it as just like any other source,
mm-hmm.
For not really that much more money than you're paying for an Xbox or a PlayStation, I don't know. I mean, I'm certainly in the minority in that, but I find them to be very excruciatingly boring.
Well, go around the other way and see where the game developers or some segment of that are putting all their energy into things like Candy Crush, as opposed to console games. But I'd also ask Jeff that, unless you get different answers than other people do, ask anyone at the Sony PlayStation or the Xbox world about 4K, and they'll change the subject. same answer twice. And yet these are the consoles of the future. Where's the 4K?
Right. No, you're absolutely right. And that was the big thing from the announcement. And I was certainly talking about that right away, of that Sony obviously trying to push 4K and their console won't do it. I think the reason for that, though, is because, in theory, their console will do movies, but it's certainly the games. They've said flat out that they won't do 4K games. And I think that's entirely a monetary decision. Right now, to get a PC that does 4K, you need some pretty heady hardware. But it was very clear, I think, several years ago that Sony and Microsoft were not going to lose the money on every piece of hardware like they used to. I mean, for the first few years, Sony lost money on every single PlayStation sold, and Microsoft as well. They made the money back. That was an investment to make the money back on licensing and peripherals and stuff.
Right.
But it was pretty clear from the way that certainly how Sony has been hemorrhaging money over the years, that the next gen was going to be cheaper to build, cheaper to make, cheaper to everything, so
more
that
commodity
they weren't
parts.
Losing money.
Right.
The street won't let them do that anymore. I mean, cell processor in PS3 has now turned into an off-the-shelf Jaguar in both of the new consoles.
Yeah, and it actually, to tie it back to my own biases, it's better for PC gamers. Because now both the PlayStation and the Xbox are basically going to be written on x86 hardware, so that the conversion over to PC should, in theory, be easier. At least that's what a lot of people are saying right now. So there'll be some of these big name titles that were never available on the PC because it was too costly to implement it and to convert it. Now it should be easier to do that, and so we'll actually see more of these games available on the PC probably later, but probably also for cheaper.
But I think that the whole thing in the gaming is something that is probably not any of us. Like that the teenagers are able to actually play and watch each other live, so that they don't have to be sitting in the same room anymore. You know, that's a really big thing, or being able to share gameplay. So it's sort of going to a different kind of gamer, kind of the younger gamer. My son also plays a lot of video games on computers, and he likes it much better, and he just really souped up his computer for that. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is gamers like me, which is
you're the target market for console games,
where the Kinect can do my heartbeat and tell me if I'm doing exercises correctly and all of that, those kind of playing games. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, Jeff, I don't know if you tried that NBA. That is amazing. I was watching it like it was a real basketball game. And plus, you can watch any of the teams from all the way back to 1960. So I could watch like the old Lakers and
they can actually win.
Nice.
Kobe isn't on the injured list all year.
That's right.
Well, let me ask you guys about one more thing about the consoles, and that is that both of them, and I think it's probably more on the Xbox side, are also touting sort of their place in the center of the entertainment universe. It's not only games, but bringing together, like we were talking about earlier, bringing together OTT, online streaming, and live TV. What's the hope there? Is that really a...
It's only Xbox.
PS3 is saying, we're a gaming console, that's it.
Yes.
And a Blu-ray player.
PS3? Okay. And they have the Blu-ray player. But there's now the Blu-ray player in the Xbox One.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of adds to them being the only thing you need in your home theater.
Right.
And, as well as now they have the TV and all the gaming, and then a lot of OTT stuff. They have just about everything that you can want. And you can, when you do a Bing, it will search all of your TV.
Mm-hmm.
And you can control your Blu-rays with voice and everything else. Mm-hmm. But from everything I've looked at, I mean, there's a really interesting thing. From everything I've looked at, the PS4, isn't it the PS4 now?
Yeah, it is.
It's just the three and I'm confused. The PS4 is really a gamer's machine. And my son works at GameStop, so he really sees that that the gamers are buying the PS4. You know, it is a gamer's machine. But people like, you know, us old moms and stuff, we're the ones who are buying the Xbox One because it gives you a lot of more options and you don't have to hook up a whole bunch of media players and everything else to be able to use it.
Mm-hmm.
But you still need a TV tuner. I think it was Barb that said that. Remember that even with the Xbox One, you need to, behind it, have a cable box or satellite box or some OTT tuner. And the question is, if the people that make those devices wise up and put the same sort of control into the set ups, then they've got...
Sorry,
Actually, Mike, I think they've got an Xfinity, and Fios also have made apps for the Xbox so that you wouldn't need a set-top box to go with it. So there are more providers who are making the apps so that you don't have to actually hook it up to another box.
If they go to IP delivery instead of RF delivery, then it really will be interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one last semi-streaming story I wanted to just touch upon, this one is one that Leo talks about all the time, and that is the death or demise, anyway, of physical media, as indicated or exemplified by the fact that Blockbuster announced this year that they were going to close the last 300 stores that they have, brick-and-mortar stores. They were up in the thousands at their peak. And now they're down to 300, and they're going to close those off, and they're going to stop their disc-by-mail service. Although they apparently will continue their streaming service. So this indicates to me, that maybe Leo is right. I hope not, because I don't want to give up physical media altogether, because that's the highest quality you're going to be able to get. Jeff, what are your thoughts?
I was pretty shocked that there were still Blockbusters open.
There's one in Burbank, in fact. There's one in my hometown.
Wow.
And it was open. I guess it's still open now, but it's on its way out for sure.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting example of, you know, corporate structure completely missing, the direction of things. I mean, they could have gotten in early on the streaming. They could have gotten in early on any of this stuff. And the disc by mail even. And they, of course, like, no, people will want to drive 15 minutes to get a movie
and then have to return it.
It just doesn't, you know, but the demise of Blockbuster could certainly make and I'm sure will make someone a book someday. I had kind of joked a couple years ago about how Blu-ray was going to be our last physical media format. And it probably will be. I mean, is it possible we'll have a 4K Blu-ray? Yeah, that might happen. But I guess maybe I have a little more faith in the potential of streaming, like that we will be able to have better better quality streaming. I mean, if you compare the HD in your head, can't obviously do it now, but if you compare the HD streaming from Netflix early on compared to what it looks like now, it's pretty different. And I mean, even like Hulu Plus, you can get basically the same looking feed through Hulu Plus that you could when you're watching it on cable. And in some cases better, obviously. There's many cable providers that look pretty terrible. So I think, better codecs, more bandwidth, I mean, things will move along that we'll see it. But those first 4K streaming that we'll certainly review, and maybe in a year, whenever, I'm sure they'll look terrible because 1080p looked terrible when they first started streaming it. The advancement for having something with better quality, I think, is always going to be there. Even if it is just in the minds of the engineers and people like us, the push will be there. I don't think there's going to be a, well, it looks terrible and that's what we'll be done with it. Because I don't think there's no history of that.
Mm. I'm sorry. Think Barb? About the Sony. The new Sony sets that come with the 4K server.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're not giving it, they're not talking about any kind of physical media. They're downloading it.
But it's downloading rather than streaming. But
it's still not physical media.
You make a good point.
But then in 5 years, you'll see a Blu-ray resurgence, like you're having a resurgence of vinyl. but if you look at the average bandwidth requirement, and it comes down to the enthusiast market, are there enough people that demand the quality who don't have the bandwidth capability in their home that will buy enough Blu-rays to keep them aside? Or will the studios just find a point where they say it's not worth it?
Right.
Or will it become kind of a distribution thing? Will it become kind of a long tail distribution where, okay, maybe there isn't the numbers to support 8 rows of Blu-rays movies in Best Buy, which incidentally, that's also gotten a lot smaller. But
yeah.
But say there isn't, they don't have there's not enough people buying them to support the floor space. But then you can on Amazon, and maybe it's a print on demand. Maybe you say, oh, I want the Blu-ray of Avengers 8. So you go online and they print it out for you and you get it in 2 days. And to you or to me or whoever, there's no difference. But that didn't exist. It's not sitting on a shelf somewhere.
Right.
That you can't. And I think that might be the gap that's bridged. I mean, you very kindly mentioned that I wrote a book. And that is the physical version of that is print on demand, that you order it and it shows up and you would never know that it didn't exist, a week earlier.
A week before you ordered it, yeah.
Yeah.
And remember that not all of the services have all of the movies. We want to watch a movie tomorrow night, and we're going to go to Blockbuster or Fry's to see if we can find one, because otherwise you have to see, if you want a new release, is it on Prime? Is it on Hulu? Is it on Netflix? Is it on this one or that one, or Vudu? And there's no guarantee. It's an annoyance to have to look around to see if the content you want to watch is there.
Well, that brings up the point that Barb made earlier, which is that Google TV, and to some extent Xbox One perhaps, are attempting to, and Google TV probably does, aggregate all of the, you say, I want to see, The Hobbit 22, and it'll show you where it is available. So that addresses that concern, Mike, a little bit.
And Scott, if the average consumer has the patience for it, I'm sorry, Barb.
Mm.
You can also Bing on the Xbox.
Uh-huh.
That's how it does it. It uses Bing. Mm-hmm. But my favorite, of course, is just to go online to canistream.it, and it will tell you exactly where it's at.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't know about that one. Canistream.it?
Yes.
Okay. Well, good. Mm-hmm. Listen, we don't have too much time left, but I did want to take a moment. We've been talking about what the big stories of 2013 were, and we were kind of been peppering in a little bit of what we might expect to see down the road. And very, very shortly down the road, all of us are going to be at CES, the Consumer Electronics Show of 2014, which last night we were talking and we were wondering, why the heck is CES in the week after New Year's? It seems like the totally wrong time to do it. And yet that's when it's always been. CES, I've heard, is scheduled in the Las Vegas Convention Center up to 20 years ahead. So
nice.
Don't expect it to change anytime soon. It's a terrible time to have this show, and yet there it is, and we're all going to be there. So what do we expect to see and hear? What are the big stories going to be from CES? We're going to talk about that after the fact, but here let's do a little prognostication, shall we? Mike, what are your expectations for what you're really going to see at CES? What's the big story is going to be?
In the video world, as we've been talking, it'll be interesting to see where the pricing and availability is going to go on OLED and 4K sets, the sizes. And I'm personally going to be watching from an economic standpoint to see where the upstarts, the Hisenses and the TCLs and that category of vendor, are they going to eventually do to LG and Samsung what Samsung and LG did to all the Japanese, formerly Japanese mainstream brands? The economics of that impact everything that we've been talking about.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very good point. And I've thought the same thing myself, that, the Koreans, Samsung and LG, kind of started eating the Japanese lunch. Now the Chinese are going to start eating the Korean lunch. And I expect that probably is a likely scenario. Jeff, what are you looking forward to seeing?
I know it's funny that you say eating their lunch, because I think the furthering of that analogy is the fact that, that the Koreans and the Japanese are both kind of serving them the lunch at this point. You know, most of the TV, like there's a significant portion of the TVs that are being, or products in general that are being made in China anyway.
Good point.
And I actually wrote an article for Reviewed.com earlier this year. It was like a long form kind of history of televisions kind of thing. And I mentioned that in there that when the Korean companies first, like Samsung and LG first came to the U.S., they were kind of considered a joke. They were this cheap, rubbish products. And then, you know, sometime in the 90s, they started kind of taking it more seriously. And then, of course, in the 2000s, no one can beat Samsung at this point. But that's only a matter of time, because back in the 80s, you would have said the same thing about Sony. And Sony, when they first came out, was another one, for example, where they first came out and said that, you know, everyone like, oh, this is just a joke little product. And then by the 80s, they owned everything. But I don't know. That's a whole other thing. But yeah, I think we're going to see bigger and smaller OLED. We'll see flat OLED. We'll see cheaper OLED. I think I will also be interested to see how the Chinese manufacturers are doing. I think their number one problem is actually marketing. I think that they don't really understand marketting too well, at least the examples.
At least in the U.S.
Yeah, exactly. And the need for marketing. And I think once that has kind of been sorted out, once the first, you know, Chinese company figures out how to do some good marketing, then that will be a serious competitor. And then I think also we didn't really talk about it too much, but this year we saw so many incredible headphones, and you know, this has really kind of been a golden era for headphones.
You know, it was something I wanted to bring up, we just got off on other tracks, which is fine, but you're exactly right. We saw a ton of headphones and pretty high quality.
A lot of them, yeah.
I think the quality is rising. So at CES, we should see that continue, don't you think?
Yeah, and it's because the market is growing so quickly, and just the tremendous size of it, there's a lot of crap. I mean, there is a significant percentage of headphones that are just atrocious.
Yeah.
But then on the same time, the cream that's at the top is really amazing. I mean, some of the best headphones ever made are being made right now.
Yeah.
And that's includes over ear and in ear headphones that you can find something at pretty much any different price point. The Wirecutter has certainly done a ton of great articles at different price points and finding what the best headphone is for under $30 or over $100 and so forth. So I think we'll certainly see a lot more of those. We'll see more, you know, horrible celebrity headphones. You can put that up either way, either horrible celebrities and their headphones or headphones that are horrible by celebrities, take your pick. But yeah, I think you'll see that, and probably a lot of good food.
And, yeah, we will have some good dinners, that's for sure.
Yeah,
no doubt about
that's
that.
That's the secret of Vegas. I don't gamble, and I don't really partake of any other crap that Vegas is known for. But the food in Vegas is some of the best in the country, which is probably would surprise most people. Sure. But yeah,
it's a very fantastic. Good point. It's a very good
pretty,
point.
Pretty good for a city in the middle of the desert.
Yeah, right. Barb, before I get to you, I just want to make sure, since we were talking about headphones, that anybody going to CES, I'm moderating a panel there on the rise of headphones, soundbars, and higher fidelity audio. So Andrew Jones is going to be on that panel.
Nice.
Somebody from Sony is going to be on that panel. So. This is definitely a trend that we're going to see moving forward and that we've already seen in 2013, and I'm glad you brought it up, Jeff. Barb, what do you expect to see in terms of streaming? I know that's kind of your beat, so.
Yeah, and I think that we're getting very mature. I mean, having a smart TV is not news really
now. Right.
How they present it might be different. I'm really thinking that this might be the year of the second screen where you're really getting other information on your tablet at the same time that you're watching TV and being able to control your TV more with your tablets and your phones and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly I think there'll be more NFC, which is that where you just kind of tap your phone on it and mirror your phone immediately to the TV set, that kind of stuff. I think there'll be more of that kind of stuff.
Cool.
I don't think it's going to be as big a year about streaming as it has in the past.
Mm-hmm. Except possibly more 4K announcements, perhaps.
Yeah.
I'll tell you guys the two big things that I'm actually looking forward to seeing at CES. One is glasses-free 3D. Now, 3D is kind of dead. You know, I mean, people aren't really that interested in it. It was always pretty controversial. Some people really hated it. Some people liked it. The studios continue to make 3D movies, and there's no doubt about that. And most TVs, at least from the midline and up, have 3D capabilities, but no one likes wearing glasses. So the interesting news in this regard is that Dolby and another much smaller company called Stream TV Networks have both been working on what's called auto-stereoscopic or glasses-free 3D. And up till recently, I've seen examples of that. I'm sure all of you have, too. That just simply wasn't very impressive. But what I've seen of the Dolby system, which is based on Philips, and the Stream TV system, actually, which is also based on Philips, but they kind of went in different directions, are pretty surprisingly good. And what I expect to see at the show this year is announcements from what are called OEM, original equipment manufacturer companies, like Samsung, Toshiba. I don't know which companies it's going to be, but some companies are going to announce actual products that implement these technologies in their TVs at CES. So that's going to be pretty interesting. The other thing that I think is even more interesting is Dolby has recently announced that they've been working on something called high dynamic range, or HDR, which basically the TV puts out much more light than we're used to and allows for a much greater detail in bright portions of the scene and dark portions of the scene at the same time. And I saw a demo of this. I was incredibly impressed. Jeff, you saw it too, didn't you?
I did.
And were you impressed?
I was. It's, to me, the interesting thing, because it's basically it's kind of like increasing the contrast ratio. Right.
That's exactly what it's doing.
And it's the TV itself, I was actually not incredibly impressed with. I mean, yes, it's very bright in the bright parts of the image and the dark parts, and it looked amazing. But in my mind, it didn't look that much better than what is possible with OLED.
Hmm.
But what they're pushing, I think, which is far more interesting, is actually a whole system based around that. So it's not just the TV itself is a higher dynamic range, which is, you know, cool, but that's, you know, no one is ever going to sell a TV with 18,000 LEDs in it. It's just never going to happen, which is what those TVs had,
correct,
or that TV had.
Right.
But the interesting thing is kind of expanding our system of our video system to have more potential more potential dynamic range.
Yep.
In the signal, and that includes like an expanded. They talked about this a little, but expanded color gamut, so you have better color, more richer colors. All that stuff is fascinating, and honestly, I think it would take a company like Dolby to push something like that through. You couldn't get one of the TV manufacturers to do it because every other TV manufacturer would just say no.
Mm-hmm.
But having someone who's more neutral like Dolby pushing it, maybe we'll see something of that. I think it would be very – we talked a little bit about that earlier where 4K Ultra HD, as you're saying, is right now only being discussed as a higher resolution, which is boring because we don't need it like we've said. But expanding the color gamut – or having a greater bit depth, all of these things are, like you said, are far more interesting. And there's a thing called Rec 2020, which talks about implementing some of this, but there's really been no movement towards it that I know of. That stuff, I think anyone going to CES, if they have a chance to check out that at Dolby, it's well worth checking out because it is a wonderful demo. The image looks incredible. It's be very cool.
It'll be very cool.
Just to put in a plug for 4K, remember to tie this together, that having a 4K panel is key to having really good 1080p per eye glasses-free 3D.
Excellent point. I'm glad you brought that up. That's exactly right. Because if you have a UHD TV with this glasses-free 3D technology, which Stream TV Networks is, that's exactly what they're doing, then you see 1080p per eye instead of 540p per eye as you would have in the past. So it's a much better quality 3D experience and glasses-free on top of that. Very comfortable, very effective. I'm assuming Dolby will do the same thing with UHD, but Mike, you make a great point there, absolutely.
Remember, as Monty Python would say, 3D isn't dead, it's only sleeping.
I'm not dead yet.
Parrot isn't dead, it's only sleeping.
Well, with that, I will bid you all a fond farewell and a very happy new year to all of you. Let's see. Jeff Morrison can be found at CNET.com and Forbes.com, TheWireCutter.com, and I think you have your own website as well, right?
Yeah, a couple of those. You can find them there, and you got my Twitter feed up on the screen there.
Got your Twitter feed up on the Tech Writer Jeff. Follow him on Twitter, absolutely. Mike, where can we find you online? Uh-oh, technical difficulties.
Residential Systems is resmagonline.com and also hiddenwires.co.uk.
Okay, great. And your Twitter feed is CaptainVid.
CaptainVid.
Right. And Barb, your website is simpletechguru.com. We can also find you at soundandvision.com, soundandvisionmag.com, right?
Either
they got rid of the mag.
Oh, they got rid of the mag. Good for them.
Yeah, finally. Either works.
Okay.
And the Sears/community, mm-hmm. you can ask any questions. I have to answer them.
You're under contract to answer every question posed.
I am. At Simple Tech Guru for my Twitter feed.
Excellent.
And please go like my Facebook page. It's Simple Tech Guru.
Very good. Very good. Well, again, happy new year to all of you. And I look forward to seeing you in less than 2 weeks at CES in fabulous Las Vegas, Nevada.
Happy new year. Cool.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for having us.
You bet.
Happy new year, Scott.
Happy new year. Okay, you can find me, of course, online at avsforum.com. And you can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and also at AVS Forum. Next week, Home Theater Geeks moves to its new day and time, Thursdays at 2:30 p.m. Pacific Time. Our first show for the new year will be a compilation of interviews that I conduct at CES at most of the major booths there in the Central Hall. I will be talking with Hisense and TCL, these two Chinese companies that are coming up fast in the world of displays. Also Panasonic, Samsung, Sharp, Sony, Toshiba, and Stream TV, this new glasses-free 3D company that I spoke about there a little while ago. Sharp. So I do hope you will tune in for that. We're going to pre-record that show. It won't be streamed live, but it will be on our new time, Thursdays, at 2:30 p.m. Pacific time. The week following that, I will have another panel with three different guests where we will talk about more of what we saw at CES, which I can't cover in one show. It's just too big, CES. I'm looking forward to being there. If any of you are going to be there at CES, be sure to go to avsforum.com and check out when I'm going to be at a couple of particular places. If you want to come and say hi, I would love to see you in person. I want to thank everybody here at Twit and in the chat room and watching at home for a great 2013. I just had a wonderful time doing this show, and lots more to come next year, so I wish everyone a happy new year and all the best for 2014. So until we meet again, geek out.